So this next topic, final one before lunch, is switching attention now to comparing one model against another. And I've tried to make this a bit lighter in terms of all the algebra content and so on than the previous two sessions. But there's still some quite important ideas to get across. And this is an area that is growing increasingly commonly used in the physics literature, physical sciences literature. And I'm hoping that you'll find some of the ideas we discuss maybe even useful in your own research work. I guess I want to invoke the spirit of Einstein here. One of Einstein's many famous quotes is one which wasn't to do with relativity or anything like that. It was just about more generally how science should work, and he said that everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. And I guess what he was driving at was that in science we do indeed try to come up with simple descriptions of how the world works, but sometimes you can go a little too far and you wind up with a description that is so oversimplified that it simply doesn't work. So there is virtue in analysing a data analysis problem in coming up with as simple a model as possible, but you want to make sure that your model isn't so simple that it fails to capture some important aspects of the phenomena that you're studying. So how might we do that? Well, what we're going to do is, as ever, go back to Bayes' theorem, and we're going to, unlike pretty much all the rest of the course, where our attention was focused on the numerator and the likelihoods and the prior, we're going to focus a bit of attention now on the denominator, the term that we previously called the evidence. So here was the version that we quickly moved on to, where it was a bit more like how you would use it in a physical sciences data analysis problem. Theta is some parameter of a model, and we've got a posterior and theta, so much of what we've talked about in these 2 days has been focused on how you would do that, how you would extract information about theta from your data. But all of that was assuming that the model was the correct one. Well, maybe it wasn't. Or maybe there's a different model with a different parameter, theta, or maybe a different name, which might be better. So how do you decide which one is best? So the quantity on the numerator, likelihood times the prior, we've talked a good deal about that. Let's now switch attention to that quantity on the denominator called the evidence. Because the posterior is a probability distribution, it's a PDF, it's got to be properly normalized. So this mysterious term on the denominator, the probability of the data given some model, that actually has to be equal to the integral you see here. What that integral is nothing more than the numerator integrated over the parameter space, theta, the parameter that describes the model. So what we've done is we've taken the likelihood, multiply it by the prior as like a almost like a weighting function, and then we've integrated over the parameter theta to get the evidence. So that really provides the key to how you might decide which of two competing models is better. Because what we do is you compute something that we refer to as the odds ratio between the models. So we say the probability of model 1 given the data divided by the probability of model 2 given the data, that's the odds ratio you want to work out. And clearly if that odds ratio is a number very much bigger than 1, then it would favour model 1 over model 2. And if the odds ratio is a lot smaller than 1, it would be favouring model 2 over model 1. So we can use Bayes' theorem to break down what that odds ratio is equal to. We can write it as the marginal probability of model 1 divided by the marginal probability of model 2 times the probability of the data given model 1 divided by the probability of the data given model 2. So these two terms are known respectively as the prior odds ratio and the Bayes factor. So the Bayes factor is just the ratio of the evidence for model 1 divided by the evidence for model 2. Now, often what we do, oops, before I go on to that, let me just say that it's often the case that we assume that the prior odds ratio is just equal to 1. So you don't have any prior favouring of one model over the other. You let the data decide which model is to be preferred. So if you do set the prior odds equal to 1, then actually the odds ratio for model 1 over model 2 is nothing more than the ratio of the evidences. So the question then is, how can you compute that evidence ratio? Well, before we try to compute it, let's just think about it in rather approximate terms, just to get an idea of what it might represent. So it's the likelihood weighted by the prior and integrated over the parameter space. So let's think of a problem where there's only a single parameter, theta, and what we're doing is you're representing the likelihood for theta, so that's the sort of brown curve here, and then you've got a prior for theta, which we've represented as the green curve. And we've supposed here that the prior is quite broad and fairly flat. So the quantity that the evidence represents is an area under a curve. And in fact, the curve is the product of this brown likelihood with the green prior. You multiply the two together, and at any value of the parameter theta, you can get that product, and then you integrate it, and you get the evidence. So if it's an area under a curve, well, area is a length times a height. So we should be able to crudely approximate that area as a length times a height. So what's a sensible choice of height to take? Well, good ballpark idea for the height would be to take the maximum of the likelihood. So that's the maximum height you can have. And, well, if you take the width of the prior, that would just be, like, because we take a fairly flat prior here, it would just be essentially the length of the flat piece of the green prior curve. If you multiplied that by L max, well, you would actually get a rectangle. Of course, clearly, that's not the area we're after. We're after an area that's a lot smaller, because for quite a lot of the prior range, the likelihood is a lot smaller than the maximum. It's very strongly peaked in our sort of cartoon here. But basically, just on dimensional grounds as much as anything else, we've got to take a height, which is L max, we're going to take that as a characteristic height. We've got to multiply that by a length. And it turns out that a suitable length to consider, just to give a rough approximation to the evidence, is the ratio of the likelihood range, that's, you know, roughly how broad the likelihood is, divided by the prior range. And this is sometimes referred to as the Occam factor. Sounds like a game show, but it's actually a reference to William of Ockham. You've probably all heard of Ockham's razor. The Ockham factor is designed to penalise models that include wasted parameter space. So in other words, even if L max is big, if the prior range is very broad, that means that you've got a term in the denominator of the Ockham factor which reduces the evidence overall. So if there's a lot of possible values for the parameter to describe the model, what it's doing is penalising models that have such freedom in them that maybe we shouldn't be too surprised that there's some value of the parameter that gives a large likelihood. We want to favour instead models which are more economical, that they've got a smaller range of parameter space available with which to fit the data. As I said, this is a reference back to William of Ockham, who said, well, translated into English, it is vain to do with more what can be done with less. I think he said it originally in Latin. He was around a long time ago. And translated into modern language, you can think of this as meaning, everything else being equal, we favour models which are simple. Or indeed, as Einstein said, that you want things to be as simple as possible, but not too simple. So Occam's razor should penalise models which are wasteful of parameter space, but you still want to have a model which gives a good fit. So you want it to have a large maximum likelihood, because otherwise you're going for a model which doesn't really describe the data at all, because you can always determine what the best fit is, but even the best fit might not be a terribly good fit. So it's striking a balance between getting a decent fit, but not doing it by using too many free parameters or too much volume of parameter space. So let's think of an example, so we don't get too bogged down in the algebra, but just a sort of simple example you can almost really sort of visualize just by eye, sort of fitting by eye. What we've got here is some data. They come from a problem to do with nucleosynthesis, the formation of the light elements in the early universe. That doesn't really matter, but it's to do with the abundance of helium. And I got these data some years ago from a chap at Ohio State University, Gary Steigman, that I'd worked with a bit over the years. And Gary Steigman had a very simple question for me. He wanted to know whether these data were best fitted by a horizontal straight line, by a straight line with a allowed non-zero slope, or by a quadratic. So what do you think? How many people here think the best fit is the red curve, the red line, in other words, or the green one, or the blue? So most people favor the blue, that's fine, but the error bars are quite large. So in fact, the fit that you get, the kind of minimum chi-squared that you get when you fit a model which is a horizontal line, or when you fit a model which is a line with a allowed non-zero slope, or you fit a model which is a quadratic, the minimum chi-squared you get in those three cases isn't actually all that different from one case to the other. So it's to do with the fact that the error bars are quite large, and of course, in the case of the blue curve, you're allowing two extra parameters. So if you think of how we introduced this, we talked about calculating the evidence and approximating that as like a maximum likelihood, so that will relate to what the minimum chi-squared is. So I'm saying that that's roughly the same for all three models, but the blue curve is a bit more wasteful of parameter space because it allows for three parameters, whereas the other models are only two and one, respectively. So it turns out when you calculate the evidence, now, to do this calculation, you've got to assume priors for the parameters. Again, I'm not going to go into the details of that, but I should emphasize that the answers I'm just going to give in a sec do depend on what priors you choose. So when you're doing evidence calculations like these, you do have to be careful to see how much your answer is affected, is changed, by changing the prior that you use, either the width of the prior or indeed the function you're using to describe the prior. But I've just taken uniform priors for the parameters. I've essentially determined the widths just from the data themselves. And here is what I got for the posterior odds ratios. I got that the odds ratio for model 1 over model 2 was about 7.2. And the odds ratio for model 1 over model 3 was 172. So despite the fact that the majority of people voted in favor of model 3, calculation of the Bayesian evidence doesn't really back that up. Now, why might that be? Well, it's to do really again with the size of those error bars. In fact, before we go on to think about changing the size of the error bars, let's just think about the numbers a bit more. So you get this whopping big number for the odds ratio of model 1 over model 3. Despite the fact that by eye, well, it does look, you have a tendency to sort of follow the curve, and yes, it does indeed seem to fit rather nicely. But the plain fact is, when you do the calculation, when you work out the evidence ratio, what it's really telling you is that because these error bars are very big, then you don't yet really have sufficient evidence to justify the inclusion of a second or indeed a third parameter. You've got maybe weak evidence in favor of the second parameter because model 1 with one parameter, that's the red line, is favored only by a factor of 7 or thereabouts over model 2. But there's a very, very strong favoring of model 1 over model 3, despite the fact that by eye, it does rather look as if the data are well described by model 3. But it's those big error bars that are really the giveaway here. what they are saying is that there's a wide range of different models that would be consistent with the data, and we have a kind of a duty to penalise models that use extra parameters that aren't necessarily needed. However, it might just be, and in fact this I think was the problem with Gary Steigman's data, it might just be that those error bars are a bit overestimated. Because in our subsequent email exchange after he'd sent me the data to see what I thought, I happened to mention in a reply, I said, "Do you really believe your error bars, Gary?" And he said, "Well, not sure, but I do think theoretically that the relationship should be a quadratic." So I said, "Well, perhaps it's just that the error bars have been overestimated." So to demonstrate that, let's just suppose that there's some simple systematic error that's been introduced which has resulted in the error bars being overestimated by a constant factor. Now, of course, it probably wouldn't be as simple as that. The error bars might be shrunk by a different amount, each one. But just to demonstrate how this was changing the evidence calculations, what we're going to do is take these error bars and just assume that somebody's messed up somewhere and they've all been overestimated by a fixed amount. So let's suppose they were overestimated by a factor of 2. So what the error bar should have looked like is what is now shown. In that case, well, we are still favouring model 1 over model 2 and model 1 over model 3, but the evidence ratio is much closer to unity. In other words, it's starting to look as if there might be a case after all for including the extra parameters, because the error bars are saying that it's a bit harder to justify the goodness of fit that you get with only a single parameter. Although, you know, to be fair, the odds ratio is still greater than unity, but it's not as overwhelmingly large as it was in the previous slide. Moreover, if the error bars had been overestimated by a factor of 3, then interestingly, what happens then is that things very quickly swing in favour of the 3-parameter model. So reducing the error bars to this level provides sufficient justification for why you do indeed need to include the extra parameters to adequately describe the data. Now, I was just doing this as a sort of little fun exercise. I had no idea whether it was justified to shrink the error bars like this. And again, there's a very inherent danger here. You know, Gary had said in his email to me that he thought, theoretically, that the curve that was the quadratic should have been the correct one. So if you think back a few slides, maybe we'll just go back there. What we said is that it's customarily the case to set the prior odds ratio to be unity. You don't favour one model over another, you just let the data decide. Well, it kind of sounded to me from Gary's emails as if he wasn't, in his head at least, setting that prior odds ratio to 1, because he really wanted it to be a quadratic. And I didn't want to be the person that was providing justification for why his prior prejudice was correct by saying, maybe you've overestimated your errors. But let's face it, sometimes people do overestimate errors. The point is, you can do this kind of exercise as an exploration to try to see how robust your results are, to see how much they would be affected by changes in the size of error bars. It doesn't mean that that's necessarily the correct thing to do, but at least it lets you see, if it were the correct thing to do, what difference it would make. Error bars sometimes are overestimated, sometimes they're also underestimated, and that can mean a result that you think is highly significant actually turns out not to be, because you were just maybe indulging in a little bit of wishful thinking in supposing that your error bars were smaller than they really were. So as I said, the principal value of this, I think, is not that it provides an absolute definitive answer one way or another, but it provides you with a tool that you can then explore and see how sensitive your results are to different choices of error bars, different choices of prior, different choices of model. So, to help see if any of that made sense, I've got a question for you. In the example, when we reduce the error bars by a factor of 3, then the posterior odds ratio in favour of model 1 over model 3 suddenly got very much less than 1. So it was now the case that the model with 3 parameters was strongly favoured over the model with only 1 parameter. So why is that happening? So the posterior odds ratio very much less than 1 can be interpreted as, well, here are 4 possible answers, including the all of the above option. So our posterior odds ratio, does it indicate a much better fit to the quadratic model than the constant model, sufficient that we can justify including an extra 2 parameters? Does it indicate that with the smaller error bars, the constant model no longer gives an acceptable fit to the data? Does it indicate that the quadratic model is much more likely than the constant model? Or is it all of the above? Okay. Now, although the example I just showed you did involve real data, it might have looked a bit like a sort of toy example because it was only 7 points and all I was doing was fitting quadratics and straight lines. But it really was, you know, data from, I guess at least to Gary Steigman, a very important question in the field of nucleosynthesis. But I thought it would be worth including a couple of slides on some work that was done by our nuclear physics group here in Glasgow. It's a few years ago now, 2008, the paper was published. But this is PhysRev Letters, which is a sort of flagship journal in the field of physics. And it was to do with an analysis of some data from the CLASS experiment. I'm not sure what CLASS stands for, but it's a large collaboration, which actually the lead author of this paper, Dave Ireland, he's now the spokesperson for that collaboration. And Brian McKinnon and Dan Potopopescu, they were also Glasgow staff working on the analysis at the time. And if you were paying much attention to the physics literature back then, well, I suppose you might not have been because some of you might have still been in high school in 2008, but back then there was quite a lot of publicity about the possible detection of a signal of something called a pentaquark. And what it boiled down to was a set of graphs, and these corresponded to different channel numbers with different energies, and basically there was a bit of a spike in one of them, which various papers had been written suggesting that this was a significant peak that was a signature of the existence of this new particle called a pentaquark. And all I want to illustrate is that Dave, leading this analysis back in 2008, got a paper in the flagship journal of physics, PhysRev Letters, and basically his analysis was just doing a Bayesian evidence calculation, exactly the same algebra that I've just gone through with you just a few slides ago. And in a sense, their paper wasn't even really reaching a definitive conclusion. All it was trying to point out was that the earlier claim of the existence of the pentaquark should maybe be taken with a bit of a pinch of salt, because depending on your choice of prior and depending on the model that you were adopting, you could get sort of a range of values for this evidence ratio. So I really just want to point out that even as recently as just 4 or 5 years ago, there were papers being published, the first sort of introductory section of which was presenting all this basic machinery of how you calculate Bayesian evidence ratios. This stuff is that new. It's not considered just old hat. You just put a reference in and send the reader to go and look at it in another paper. This was still, for PhysRev Letters, considered sufficiently new and innovative that Dave got his paper published, and it led to lots of subsequent papers and discussion about the results and so on. Okay, things are changing. It's now a bit more just part of the furniture. If you look at the physics literature in a range of fields, these evidence calculations are now just part and parcel of what people do. but it's only still a few years ago that this was really cutting-edge stuff. And hopefully you've got a sense from this that the calculations aren't really all that difficult. You're just doing some simple integrations, and in fact we'll briefly touch this afternoon on a very powerful method called nested sampling, which lets you work out evidence ratios very, very simply, just like a few lines of code, and you can do it. So I'm not saying you would necessarily get yourself a paper in PRL by doing a Bayesian evidence calculation, but you never know. One of my graduate students has just submitted a paper to Astrophysics Journal Letters, which is a sort of an astronomy, the equivalent of PRL, and it's a four-page paper redoing an analysis to reassess a claim to do with glitches in pulsars, and basically we did, just like what Dave did, a reanalysis using Bayesian evidence. Now that paper isn't published yet, so I thought I'd maybe better not put it in the slides for the course this year. But, I mean, from start to finish, I think we're going to turn the paper out in about 3 or 4 days, because the calculations were very straightforward to do, and it's actually a fairly short and quite succinct paper. It remains to be seen if it will get published. But the referee's reports were quite favourable, so we've just got a few minor changes to make, and hopefully it will get accepted. So the basic tools of doing model comparison using Bayesian inference are now out there in the literature. They're being used increasingly across the fields of physical sciences. I would encourage you, if you're working in a problem where you're in a situation where you're kind of comparing one model with another, then try doing this. And it can add some useful insight to your analysis. And I now just want to give more of a kind of textbook example of these Bayesian evidence calculations in a situation which might well mirror a situation that you could have with your own data analysis. Now, I touched on this yesterday because it was to do with fitting the parameters of a spectral line. So you've got data in certain energy channels, you've got amplitudes, and you're trying to fit a line profile. So you might remember at the end of yesterday we looked at that, and it was like a Gaussian profile, and we were fitting amplitudes, but we were also fitting the channel number. But I posed the question that maybe it wasn't immediately obvious from the data how many spectral lines you should be fitting. So I just want to present a little bit more on that problem so that you can see how you could use Bayesian evidence calculations to help answer that. So the model we've got here is, again, the model of a Gaussian. So there's a certain amplitude A, and then the Gaussian shape with a certain width W. But what you see here is that sometimes you can have lines which overlap with each other, which blends them together, and maybe does make it a bit hard to disentangle how many lines there are. And then, of course, you've got noise, which messes things up as well. Now, if the lines are quite well separated, and if the noise isn't too large, the noise will manifest itself both in terms of the error bars you see in the vertical direction, but also you'll get blurring in the horizontal direction, so lines will get spread out a bit. And there might also be a background, and the background might be non-constant, so you've got that to disentangle as well. So the observed data can be quite complicated. But if you treat the number of lines itself as a free parameter, then you can crank through some messy algebra and you can arrive at an expression which is the probability for there being m lines in your data given the data. So it involves a likelihood, it involves a prior, and it involves an evidence. So taking a uniform prior on m, so that just means that you don't presuppose there's a certain number m, you just say, well, it could be anything between 0 and 20 lines, or, you know, it could be any number you like, really. That's probably the most sensible choice of prior here. And you just perform the calculations. The trouble is, if the number of lines is even more than just a few, you're straight away facing having to do a multi-dimensional integral to integrate over the prior parameter space. So that's a parameter space in the amplitude of the line, maybe also the position or the wavelength of the line or the channel number. But the basic ingredients are just the same. You've got to do that integral over the likelihood weighted by the prior, and then out pops your evidence, which you can then turn into a posterior odds ratio. So if you take uniform priors on all those parameters, then the multidimensional integral will look something like this. You'll have an e to the minus a half chi squared term, and then you'll have some factors like this out the front, which are really just a measure of the volume of the prior parameter space, and you've got to work those out for different values of m. So here's a simulated example, and these are our data, and what we're asking is how many lines are there in that data set. Now, hopefully no one's going to disagree on there being four. The question is, are there more than four? Could it be that maybe that one there is two lines very close together, which are blended together? So the conservative answer would be that you assume there's four, because, you know, that's sort of obvious. After that, you would really like the data to tell you how many lines there are by calculating the evidence. Now, other ways in which this could be further complicated is if you don't know what the blurring function is. That would give you extra, remember the term nuisance parameters, that you would have to marginalize over. But let's assume the blurring function is known. So that's how much each line is spread out by. So ultimately that's going to determine how close together the lines can be before you can't tell them apart. So if you know what your blurring function is, then you can calculate the evidence for a certain number of lines. And this is the calculation that we get for that simple example. So it's the log of the evidence, and the log of the evidence is about minus 12 for four lines. Now, that sounds like an extraordinarily small number, but this is unnormalized. The point is the normalization constant, if you're comparing one model with another, drops out, because the normalization constant is just to do with the data and not to do with the number of lines. So even though this number looks incredibly small, it's just because in order to do the calculation, we haven't bothered normalizing the problem. There's no real need to. Because really, in the end, what you're only ever interested in is ratios of these evidence values. What you want to know is, what's the relative probability of five lines versus four lines? Or six lines versus five? Or six versus four? So don't worry about this scale looking like what it does. The important thing is that the evidence, or the log of the evidence, for five lines is way up here, close to zero. So despite what it might look like by eye, there is actually sufficient evidence in these data, at least given the priors that were assumed, to say that there's five lines. Now again, the priors might be wrong, or the blurring function might not be what you think it is. So the sensible thing would be to redo the analysis where you vary all of those things to make sure your answer is robust. But look, this is a factor of 12 or thereabouts between the evidence, or the log evidence for five lines and the log evidence for four. So that's a difference of 12. Kind of said that wrong. What I mean is a difference of 12 in the log, which corresponds to a factor of e to the 12. Sorry, it's 10 to the 12 because it's log 10 in this case. My apologies. So, you know, 10 to the 12 is a big, big odds ratio. So even allowing for maybe some uncertainty in the blurring function or changing the prior, you're really probably not going to change the odds ratio sufficiently to favour there being four lines over five. So it looks very much as if these data support there being five lines. Now after that, for six, seven, eight, and so on, what you see is a gradual decline in the log of the evidence. And my question to you is, what's the reason for that? So the evidence is smaller for n greater than five, most likely because the maximum likelihood fit is poorer for m greater than 5. The prior on m is smaller for m greater than 5. The improvement in the maximum likelihood fit for m greater than 5 is more than offset by the reduced Occam factor, remember, the Occam factor is to do with there being more free parameters, or is it none of the above? So is it because the maximum likelihood fit just gets worse? Is it to do with the prior? Is it to do with the improvement in the maximum likelihood fit not being good enough to justify the extra parameters, or is it none of those? So that was question 17. Only three to go. So if you take the number of lines to be the number given by the maximum of the evidence, it's 5, and then fixing n to be 5, you can now work out what the amplitudes that are best fit by the data are, and what the scattering angles are, basically corresponding to the wavelengths. So according to these data, this is where the lines are, based on a model for which m equals 5. So actually it was down here where the lines were apparently blended together. Go back to the original data. So there's maybe a hint of that. It's basically the kind of little hump that you see here. Now, as I said, that's all based on an assumed blurring function. So again, if you had that blurring function completely wrong, then sure enough, you might wind up with a different value for the evidence. And I have to confess, I haven't redone the calculations in this case. It's just designed to be an illustrative example, but as I said, because the difference in the evidence is so large, or the product, not product, the exponential, or you know, 10 to the power of the log 10 evidence differs by a factor of 10 to the 12, then it would seem that the evidence in favour of 5 lines is actually pretty strong in this case. So the thing I referred to before about the calculations involving multidimensional integrals, you know, that is just an unavoidable consequence of there being a large number of parameters to integrate over. And very quickly, that can become completely unmanageable. If you've really got more than just a few parameters, then this is going to get very, very slow to do the calculations. So we can approximate the evidence in a number of ways. In fact, when I first taught this course, there was a lot of focus on this kind of stuff, on using something called the information criteria, or another way to approximate the evidence called the Laplace approximation or the Savage-Dicke approximation. And only just hot off the press was a method called nested sampling that was just beginning to be used in fields of physics. To save a little bit of time, I'm not actually going to cover the information criteria and the Laplace and the Savage-Dicke this time, because it's basically become so easy now to implement nested sampling that people, at least in the physics literature, are almost never using these approximate methods anymore. I see fewer and fewer papers that are doing it that way. Most people are just using nested sampling or something like it. There's a few other methods as well, something called population Monte Carlo, and other methods called important sampling. They all provide ways of numerically approximating the evidence that can be done with just a short piece of code. So this afternoon, if time allows, I'll show you just a little bit of how nested sampling works, and hopefully you'll see for yourself that it, you know, is sufficiently straightforward to implement that you could do it with just a short piece of code yourself rather than resorting to these approximations. So a few slides I can skip over, which brings lunch a bit closer. But I just want to show you one before I move on. One of the approximations that was being used in the mid-2000s was called the Laplace approximation. And I just want to mention, this is work done by Roberto Trotta, who was at Oxford at the time. And the context, again, doesn't really matter, but this was for parameters to do with the cosmic background radiation, which is still very much at the forefront of a lot of research in cosmology. There was a Planck satellite that reported its results early in 2013. So what you see here are confidence regions, or credible regions, for pairs of parameters. So it links a bit to the stuff I talked about in the first lecture this morning. And I just want to mention that what you see in the red are all ellipses. So those are examples of where you've assumed that the posterior is Gaussian, and you've used the Fisher matrix to work out what the errors in the parameters are. And what the Laplace approximation was designed to do was to go slightly better and to calculate the confidence regions when you don't assume that the posterior is Gaussian. And fortunately, what you can see in this case is that they agree extremely well, which suggests that the assumption of a Gaussian posterior was actually pretty good. These were data from the WMAP satellite, which was the sort of precursor to Planck. Well, it was launched by NASA. Planck was a European mission, but in the early 2000s, WMAP was launched and was doing analysis of the microwave background already to very high precision, but Planck came along and did it even better. So there's very good agreement between the Laplace approximation and this MCMC sampled posterior. And the fact that they agree so well in turn tells you that the assumption of Gaussianity is really not such a bad one for the posterior in that case. And then nested models, again, we can avoid that because it's sort of dropped out of fashion because really in a way it's not needed. So these days, if you want to calculate the evidence, it's perfectly possible to do it using a short piece of code, using a method like nested sampling or some other kind of Monte Carlo sampling method. And that's what we're going to talk about after lunch. We're going to talk about Monte Carlo simulation methods.